process. Do you think Reverend Wright loves America as much as you do?
Do you understand that some people in this state find that patronizing and think that you said actually what you meant?
Can you explain that relationship for the voters and explain to Democrats why it won't be a problem?
ABC News is coming under intense criticism for its handling of the Democratic debate in Pennsylvania. We'll talk to Glenn Greenwald, author of Great American Hypocrites. Then No Bases for Empire. We'll be joined by two guests, one from Diego Garcia, one from the Czech Republic. But first, the death penalty. Several states announced plans to resume executions after the Supreme Court upholds Kentucky's methods of execution by lethal injection. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 300,000 U.S. troops who served in Iraq and Afghanistan are suffering from major depression or post-traumatic stress disorder. This according to a new study by the RAND Corporation. Researchers say nearly 20% of the troops who served in the war zones are suffering PTSD and depression, but only half of them have sought treatment. RAND researcher Terry Tenilin said, quote, unless they receive appropriate and effective care for these mental health conditions, there will be long-term consequences for them and for the nation. The study also estimates 320,000 service members had experienced a possible traumatic brain injury while deployed. Researchers say female soldiers and reservists had the highest rates of post-traumatic stress disorder and major depression. Meanwhile, in Texas, the Dallas VA Medical Center has been forced to close its psychiatric ward to new patients after the suicides of four veterans this year. At least 50 Iraqis died Thursday when a suicide bomber that struck the funeral of two Sunni brothers. Both men belonged to the Awakening Council, a Sunni-led group opposed to al-Qaeda's presence in Iraq. The suicide bomber walked into a tent crowded with mourners and detonated explosives strapped to his body. It was the deadliest blast in Iraq in over a month. The Los Angeles Times reports the bombing was the latest strike in an internal war among Sunni Arabs, some of whom have aligned themselves with the Americans and others with al-Qaeda in Iraq. In Baghdad, the New York Times reports U.S. forces have begun building a massive concrete wall partitioning part of the Shiite neighborhood of Sadr City from the rest of Baghdad. U.S. officials say they want to turn the southern quarter of Sadr City near the Green Zone into a protected enclave secured by Iraqi and American forces. Meanwhile, a new study by the Pentagon's premier military educational institute has concluded the war in Iraq has become a major debacle, and the outcome is in doubt, despite the so-called surge. The opening line of the report says, quote, measured in blood and treasure, the war in Iraq has achieved the status of a major war and a major debacle. The study was released by the National Institute for Strategic Studies, a Pentagon research center. The Wall Street Journal reports U.S. commanders in Iraq have begun releasing hundreds of Iraqi prisoners after concluding the military's detention policy might be harming U.S. goals in Iraq. The U.S. is currently holding about 23,000 Iraqis, many without charge. The U.S. military has begun building a pair of large halfway houses in Taji and Ramadi, where detainees will undergo vocational training. The Wall Street Journal reports the U.S. military also plans to teach religious courses to the former prisoners about how to be a moderate Muslim. Imams will be brought in by the military to teach courses that highlight the Islamic precepts that bar the killing of innocents and offer alternative interpretations of jihad. In news from Africa, Kenya has sworn in a power-sharing government nearly 4 months after a disputed election plunged the East African country into a bloody crisis that left more than 1,200 people dead. Mwai Kibaki will remain as president, and his chief rival, Raila Odinga, will serve as prime minister. The two men met secretly recently to break a six-week deadlock over forming the coalition. Prime Minister Raila Odinga said Kenya must remain united.
We have been to hell and back. Never again in our history must we return to those times. We must preserve the sanctity of our nation, state, and remain united. But our unity cannot be based on words and goodwill alone.
Pope Benedict XVI met privately with a group of victims of clergy sex abuse Thursday on the third day of his U.S. trip. The unannounced meeting took place in the chapel of the Papal Embassy. Earlier in the day, Pope Benedict discussed the impact the scandal has had on the Catholic Church.
That I acknowledge the pain which the Church in America has experienced as a result of the sexual abuse of minors. No words of mine could describe the pain and harm inflicted by such abuse. It is important that those who have suffered be given loving pastoral attention. Nor can I adequately describe the damage that has occurred within the community of the Church.
Amnesty International is calling on the Israeli government to investigate the recent killings of Palestinian civilians and a Reuters journalist in Gaza. Reuters cameraman Fidel Shana was struck by fire from an Israeli tank while he was filming. He traveled to the scene in a car clearly marked Press TV. He was killed as he started to film the tank. Doctors in Gaza have revealed that Fidel Shana was killed by a controversial weapon that fired metal darts from a tank shell. Several of the 3-centimeter-long darts, known as flechettes, were embedded in Shana's legs and chest. Israeli doctors and Palestinian human rights groups attempted to get the U.S.-supplied weapons banned in Israel 5 years ago. Reuters senior Gaza correspondent Nidal Omagabi condemned the killing of Fidel Shana.
What happened was very tragic. Today is a very black day. Today is a very sad day. We all know that this was the price for Fadl's dedication and bravery. And this is the kind of price dedicated journalists pay in areas as risky as Gaza. Reuters has demanded a full and thorough investigation into the circumstances of Fadl's killing, and we will await the investigation.
Former President Jimmy Carter is heading to Syria today for talks with Hamas leader Khaled Mashal. Carter said the meetings with Hamas are necessary to move forward the Israeli-Palestinian peace process.
Leaders of Hamas, would they accept a proposition that if there is success between Abu Mazen and the Prime Minister of Israel, and they reach an agreement on all the issues, the major issues, and if they were then submitted to a referendum of a Palestinian community, and the Palestinians approve, would Hamas accept that agreement? And the answer was yes.
Carter also criticized the Israeli blockade of the Gaza Strip. He said, quote, it's an atrocity what is being perpetrated as punishment on the people in Gaza. It's a crime. He said Palestinians are starving to death because of the blockade. In economic news, Merrill Lynch has announced plans to eliminate 4,000 jobs this year, about 10% of the workforce. The investment bank lost $2 billion in the first 3 months of the year. Meanwhile, the student loan crisis is worsening. On Thursday, Bank of America announced it's ending its private student loan business for the coming year. The bank will continue to offer loans through the federal student loan program. The Boston Globe reports more than 50 firms have abandoned abandoned or cut back their federal or private student loan programs this year, unable to raise money in the financial markets. The world's largest gold miner, Barrick Gold, is threatening to sue a small Canadian book publisher over a new book detailing abuses Canadian-owned businesses have committed in Africa. The book links Barrick Gold to the deaths of 52 Tanzanian miners who were buried alive in 1996. The mine was owned at that time by the Vancouver-based Sutton and sold to Barrick in 1999. But the authors of the book suggest Barrick acted with Sutton to prepare the deposit for large-scale development. According to the CanWest News Service, the Quebec Publishing has decided to go ahead with publishing the book despite the threat from Barrick. And on Capitol Hill, Democratic Congressmember Barney Frank of Massachusetts has introduced legislation aimed at removing federal penalties on personal marijuana use. The legislation would also allow the medical use of marijuana in states that have chosen to make it its use for medical purposes legal with a doctor's recommendation. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We are broadcasting from Houston, Texas. In a blow to anti-death penalty activists, the Supreme Court ruled on Wednesday that execution by lethal execution in Kentucky does not violate constitutional protections against cruel and unusual punishment. The 7-2 decision effectively lifts a de facto moratorium on lethal injections. Several states, including Texas, Florida, Virginia, Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, and Oklahoma, have already announced plans to resume executions. The decision came one day after Amnesty International named the United States one of the top five executioners in the world, along with China, Iran, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia. Today, we look at Texas, the execution capital of the United States. When reached for comment, the Texas Department of Criminal Justice said no executions have been scheduled as yet, but death row prisoners in the state could be put to death as early as 30 days from today. But Houston's chief prosecutor, Kenneth Magnuson, said he would seek execution dates for at least six death row prisoners, quote, in due course. Texas Governor Rick Perry applauded the court's decision, saying that, quote, Texas is a law and order state, and I stand by the majority of Texans who support the death penalty as it is written in Texas law. It is an appropriate response for the most violent crimes against our fellow human beings, he said. David Atwood is the founder of the Texas Coalition Against the Death Penalty, joining me here in Houston, Texas. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much, Amy.
Can you talk about the significance of the Supreme Court ruling?
Well, for Texas, it's very significant because we have 370 people on death row. We will probably have, between now and the end of the year, we could have 20 or 25 executions in this state as a result of this ruling. And so, more than any other state, the ruling will have a big impact on Texas. And, of course, we didn't want this to happen. We would have liked any other decision other than this decision. But we think also that there will be other challenges on the lethal injection question. And there could be many other things that could be brought up with time also that really make it very clear to us that the death penalty as being applied here in Texas in particular is unconstitutional.
Explain, though, the significance of the Supreme Court decision. What was the case that came forward in this?
Okay, this was a Kentucky case. It goes under the name of Bays, who is one of the prisoners who brought this case forth. And the question was the method of execution, the lethal injection process that's used in Kentucky. And the position of the defendant was that it's cruel and unusual punishment because of the three chemicals that are used in the lethal injection procedure. Basically, those chemicals are used in all states. We use them here in Texas. It's you start off with a sedative, then another chemical that paralyzes the muscles, and then a third chemical that actually stops the heart. And they tried to make the case that this could cause excruciating pain if not done properly. And the Supreme Court basically said that they didn't make the case. And so they lost that particular case. There are challenges in other states also. So it's not done yet totally, but this is really significant, what happened in Kentucky, and it really has opened up the door for many more executions.
So how will these prisoners die in Texas if executed?
Well, it'll be lethal injection. We've used this method. In fact, the first lethal injection in the United States was done in Texas back in 1982. The method was created by a pharmacist in Oklahoma, actually, but Texas was the first state to use it. And since we started back up in 1982, we've had 405 executions in this state alone, which is the next nearest state, I think, is Virginia, that's had 98. So we're way out in front when it comes to the executions. And like I say, we have 370 people on death row.
David Atwood, how did you get involved with the death penalty?
I got involved initially through my church, and then I was asked by a Catholic nun to visit some prisoners on death row. It was not Sister Helen Prejean, it was another person. And when I first went to death row, that's what really really got me involved in this issue, because I saw the people on death row, despite what they had done as human beings, and also became aware of all the problems in the criminal justice system and realized that the death penalty was actually totally unnecessary for the protection of society, because we can keep people safe, we can keep society safe through long-term imprisonment when necessary. And so that goes back almost 20 years ago when I first started to get involved.
And who is involved in the anti-death penalty movement here in Houston? And why is this state called the death penalty capital of the United States?
Well, the people that are involved in the anti-death penalty work come from every section of society that you can imagine. We have former military people. Believe it or not, we're not all Democrats. We have Republicans in our organization, too. And a lot of people are just concerned about this issue. But we have become the death penalty capital of certainly the United States, and really, in a sense, the Western world, because we have like Governor Perry said, he says we're a law and order state. And of course, my response to that is that all states are law and order states. I don't know of a state that isn't law and order. But the politicians of this state, the governor, we had Governor Bush before, and now Governor Perry, between the two of those men, we've had over 300 executions just by them alone. And so the politicians in this state really embrace the death penalty. I don't think that the citizens of Texas have a love affair with the death penalty, although the governor would like to say that and will make these public statements.
What about the stances of the presidential candidates?
Well, none of them have officially come out against the death penalty. We know that McCain probably would hold fast to this, having the death penalty. I think Hillary Clinton would too, based on, past experience, what we know about them. But Barack Obama has not really come out officially against the death penalty, but we feel that he probably would have a much more reasoned approach to it, and that he probably would bring up questions about how it's being used and if it's really needed. And so, personally, this is a personal opinion, that I think that he would be the best of the three candidates on our issue.
But he hasn't come out against the death penalty.
No, he has not. He did work in Illinois to make the procedures more fair, which I think was good. And, a lot of the politicians think that if you come out against the death penalty, that this is the kiss of death for their political career. I don't think that's true. But a lot of them believe that.
Well, I want to thank you very much, David Atwood, for joining us. David Atwood is the founder of the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
Okay, Amy. Thank you.
can talk to me. You can talk to me beyond the wizard's sleeve here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're broadcasting on 700 stations, Pacifica and NPR, low-power college and community radio stations on public access TV and PBS TV stations on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available in Spanish for over 180 stations are taking them. Any radio station can take them at our website. Well, ABC News is coming under intense criticism for its handling of Wednesday night's Democratic debate in Pennsylvania. It was the last before next week's primary. During the first 45 minutes of the debate, the moderators, Charles Gibson and George Stephanopoulos, focused on Obama's comments that some voters in Pennsylvania were bitter. The Reverend Jeremiah Wright controversy, Clinton's Bosnia sniper fire story, flag pin, and the weather underground. Here are some of the questions.
The candidates await. Charles Gibson and George Stephanopoulos.
You got talking in California about small town Pennsylvanians who have had tough economic times in recent years, and you said they get bitter and they cling to guns or they cling to their religion or they cling to antipathy toward people who are not like them. Now, you said you misspoke, you said you mangled what it was you wanted to say. But we've talked to a lot of voters. Do you understand that some people in this state find that patronizing and think that you said actually what you meant?
Let me pick up on this. When these comments from Senator Obama broke on Friday, Senator McCain's campaign immediately said that it was going to be a killer issue in November.
Senator Obama, since you last debated, you made a significant speech in this building on the subject of race and your former pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. Senator, let me follow up, but let me add to that. You have said that he would not have been my pastor. And you said that you have to speak out against those kinds of remarks and implicitly by getting up and moving, and I presume you mean out of the church. Do you honestly believe that 8,000 people should have gotten up and walked out of that church?
Senator, two questions. Number one, do you think Reverend Wright loves America as much as you do? Senator Clinton, we also did a poll today, and there are also questions about you raised in this poll. About 6 in 10 voters that we talked to don't believe you're honest and trustworthy. And we also asked a lot of Pennsylvania voters for questions they had. A lot of them raised this honesty issue and your comments about being under sniper fire in Bosnia. And you yourself has said she hasn't been fully truthful about what she would do as president. Do you believe that Senator Clinton has been fully truthful about her past?
The question raised by a voter in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, a woman by the name of Nash McCabe. Take a look.
Senator Obama, I have a question, and I want to know if you believe in the American flag. I am not questioning your patriotism, but all our servicemen, policemen, and EMS wear the flag. I want to know why you don't.
Follow up. On this issue, general theme of patriotism in your relationships, a gentleman named William Ayers, he was part of the Weather Underground in the 1970s. They bombed the Pentagon, the Capitol, and other buildings. He's never apologized for that. And in fact, on 9/11, he was quoted in the New York Times saying, "I don't regret setting bombs. I feel we didn't do enough." An early organizing meeting for your state Senate campaign was held at his house, and your campaign has said you were friendly. Can you explain that relationship for the voters and explain to Democrats why it won't be a problem?
Oh, you can. The crowd's turning on me. The crowd is turning on me.
Just some of the questions in the first half of last night's presidential debate on ABC. The primetime debate was seen by 10.7 million people, according to Nielsen Media Research. That's the most of any debate this election cycle. According to the Associated Press, nearly 17,000 comments were posted on ABC News website by Thursday evening. The tone overwhelmingly negative. Tom Shales of the Washington Post said Gibson and Stephanopoulos, quote, turned in shoddy, despicable performances. The media critic, Greg Mitchell, said it was, quote, perhaps the most embarrassing performance by the media in a major presidential debate in years. Salon.com said, quote, I'm not sure if we've seen anything quite as train wreck, cover your eyes, bad as the spectacle on ABC last night. Will Bunch, a Philadelphia Daily News writer, posted an open letter to Gibson and Stephanopoulos on his blog telling them, quote, you disgrace the American voters and, in fact, even disgrace democracy itself. And the group Move On said it would air an ad protesting ABC if 100,000 people sign their petition. Glenn Greenwald is a former constitutional law attorney, now a contributing writer at Salon.com. He's the author of a number of books. His latest is called Great American Hypocrites. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Glenn Greenwald.
Great to be back. Thanks, Amy.
You've been blogging a great deal about this debate. Can you talk about what happened on Wednesday night in Pennsylvania?
Well, in one sense, it was an extreme and rather transparent act of journalistic malfeasance. I mean, that's just obvious. Take a look at just some of the stories that you reported on in the prior segment, virtually all of which were completely absent from the debate. Instead, the first half of the debate focused almost exclusively on the type of petty, insipid, personality-based attacks that dominate our political discourse and determine our national elections. But in another sense, I think it's important to note that this debate is not in any way aberrational. I mean, in heaping all this scorn on what George Stephanopoulos and Charlie Gibson have done, I think it's important to acknowledge the fact that really all they're doing is what is done continuously throughout our election cycles for decades now. This was sort of a more transparent act because all of these vapid questions were bunched together at the beginning. But it's worth recalling that over the past couple of weeks, the news cycle was dominated by the scandal that Barack Obama wants to be President of the United States, even though he doesn't bowl very well, which was followed by the comments that he made in San Francisco, what Maureen Dowd in the New York Times called the capital of elitism, and prior to that, there was the lapel pin controversy, the never-ending fixation on Jeremiah Wright's video, the comments made by Barack Obama's wife, Michelle, all of this culminating in this theme that Barack Obama is this exotic, bizarre, elitist, out of touch with mainstream American values, subversive, anti-American. And these are the themes which over and over and over and over again are used to demolish and destroy the character and personality of Democrats and progressives, going all the way back to Jimmy Carter, Walter Mondale, Michael Dukakis, and on, to the point where none of the substantive issues and the weighty crises that our country faces in every realm are really a part of our national elections. And I think Charlie Gibson and George Stephanopoulos, though a bit more extreme and really more transparent, I would say, in just how vapid they are, we're really doing what the establishment media does pretty much without exception in terms of how it covers our political culture.
George Stephanopoulos, the former Clinton aide, President Clinton, said he had asked fair, tough questions, the kind of questions that would be asked later. What is your response to that, Glenn Greenwald?
This is the justification that reporters use repeatedly whenever they focus on insipid, substance-free stories. They pretend that if it were strictly up to them, they, of course, would focus on the serious, substantive matters that the country faces because they're politically sophisticated observers. The problem, they say, is that Americans, the sort of heartland voter whom they patronizingly look down upon, is interested in these sort of personality-based, drudge-like issues. And therefore, they have no choice but to report them, since these are the issues that are going to predominate in our political process. Now, leave aside the question as to whether or not journalists, holding themselves out as political journalists, have an obligation to focus on the more substantive matters independent of what they can do in order to generate as high ratings as possible. Even if you assume that political journalism ought to simply feed the public whatever the public wants, response. There's no evidence whatsoever to suggest that the American public is more interested in Barack Obama's bowling score or whether he wears a lapel pin than they are in how our political leaders are going to address the grave economic insecurities that the country faces or extricate ourselves from the debacle in Iraq that's becoming increasingly savage and brutal without any end in sight. This is a fiction, an invention on the part of political journalists to justify their never-ending coverage of trash. And in fact, there's much evidence to suggest, and you can ask any political elected official, that when they go back to their district, what they hear continuously are grave complaints from their constituents and others about just how ridiculous and inane political coverage is and how dominated it is by matters that have nothing to do with their lives and with the problems that they face. And these journalists believe that they're sort of spokespeople for the people in the heartland and speak for them and patronizingly say that they're interested in these insipid issues and that's why they're covered. The reality is there's no connection between the establishment journalistic class and the people whom they claim to represent. And the reason they cover those issues is because they, the journalists, want to cover them, not because the people want to hear them.
Now, Stephanopoulos said overall the questions were tough, fair, relevant, and appropriate, and rejected the claim by Obama supporters that the debate had been stacked against him, saying Hillary had faced sharp questioning as well. Glenn Greenwald.
Well, you can just simply look at the way that the first 50 minutes of the debate evolved. It was true that she was asked a question about her purported dishonesty and the quote-unquote scandal of her claiming that she was under sniper fire in Bosnia, and that was the type of question that Obama was subjected to as well. But what you really see happening here is throughout 2007, when it looked as though Hillary was going to be the nominee, or at least the media and the right wing assumed that that was the case, she was the target overwhelmingly of these sorts of attacks. The media discussed at length what they said was her artificial laugh, the sort of cackle that kind of masked a soulless, satanic quest for power underneath. They talked about whether she was showing cleavage. These kinds of personality attacks were directed at her when it looked as though she was a nominee. Now that Obama looks to be the nominee, and the media and the right assume that, he clearly is receiving the preponderance of these attacks. And as I said, it's always done in the same demonizing way to suggest that he's out of touch with mainstream America, even though he grew up as in a single home and his accomplishments are self-made, in contrast to George Bush and John McCain, and that he obviously is subversive and hates America and won't defend it the way all progressives won't. And that's the theme that clearly is being dumped on him the way it always is whenever they identify who they think the progressive leader is.
At one point in the debate, Senator Obama voiced his frustration with the questions by the ABC moderators.
I think what's important is to make sure that we don't get so obsessed with gaffes that we lose sight of the fact that this is a defining moment in our history. We are going to be tackling some of the biggest issues that any president has dealt with in the last 40 years.
Yeah, that Senator Obama talking to the moderators. Glenn Greenwald.
Yeah, I mean, he's absolutely right about that. I mean, what's so ironic about this is that ABC melodramatically touted this debate as one that would confront grave constitutional questions. It was in the National Constitution Hall, and that was how they touted it. If you look at public opinion polls, the American public knows that there's something fundamentally wrong with our country. 8 out of 10 Americans think the country is dramatically off track. We have one of the most radical and hated administrations in modern American history that has dismantled our constitutional framework. That has brought us into extreme economic precariousness and disrepute around the world. And yet here are our leading journalists asking these type of questions as though those are the things that Americans want to hear. And what happens is whenever you point out that it is the media that is rendering our political discourse so toxic in a way that really disserves the American public, the way that Obama did, most journalists will immediately start banding together and attacking wing, whoever the critic is, who points out the media behavior. And so you had all journalists across the board, Roger Simon in the Politico, Mark Amador in the Atlantic, and especially David Brooks in the New York Times, essentially attacking Obama for being too petulant or for being too soft and incapable of withstanding the hardships of political battle, as though there's something adversarial and substantive about what it is that they're doing, rather than trashy and petty. And again, you saw there's a column from David Brooks this morning, who always thinks he's the spokesman for Heartland American Values, who says that the reason why things like John Kerry's windsurfing tights and John Edwards' haircut and Barack Obama's bowling score are relevant is because that's what the American people care about. And Barack Obama, who spent the last 15 months going around the country and speaking to the American people, knows that that's not the case. Everyone knows that that's not the case. But when you point out the corruption of the journalist class, of course, you then immediately become the target of attack by the PAC mentality in which journalists operate.
Glenn Greenwald, your new book has just come out this week, Great American Hypocrites, Toppling the Myths of Republican Politics. Can you talk about how the media portrays John McCain?
Can you repeat that question? There was a problem with the audio, and I actually didn't hear it.
Can you talk about how the media portrays John McCain?
Well, there's simply no political figure in the last several decades, and this includes the canonized Ronald Reagan, and it includes the swaggering war hero George Bush in 2003, who is as revered and loved and really worshipped by the establishment media the way that John McCain is. It simply is, there's no parallel to it. And oddly enough, a lot of the reporters who travel around with him are so enamored of him that they actually acknowledge the deep affection that they have for him. And they do so without shame, as though it's just natural that they would have such overwhelming affection for someone like John McCain. They actually, about a month ago, 6 weeks ago, spent a weekend at his ranch in Arizona, drinking wine, swinging on tires, hanging from his swing set. In 2004, many of the leading journalists in our country, anchors on network news, correspondents on cable news networks, went to various Manhattan restaurants, traveling around with McCain, celebrating his birthday, toasting him, singing songs to him. There's so many examples that demonstrate how this affects the coverage. But the fact that his character is built up into this honor-bound man of principle, this heroic, strong, protective figure, is very consistent with how Republican and right-wing leaders are always built up, first by the right wing and then by the media. But it seeps into coverage even more. There was an example that was incredible. About 3 weeks ago, John McCain was traveling around the Middle East with his top Middle East advisor, Joe Lieberman. And on many occasions, four separate occasions at least, John McCain said falsely that Iran was importing al-Qaeda warriors into Iran, training them, and then sending them back into Iraq. That's something that not even people like Bill Kristol would claim to be the case. It's clearly false. And he finally was forced to retract it when, on the fourth occasion, Joe Lieberman whispered in his ear that it wasn't true. And yet the media virtually ignored that story completely, notwithstanding the fact that it means either that John McCain is completely ignorant about the most basic facts of the Middle East, the area that he claims to be a strong suit, or that he, more likely, is engaging in the type of deceit that the Bush administration has engaged in for the last 8 years, where they link whoever the enemy is of the week to al-Qaeda. They're training al-Qaeda. They're working with al-Qaeda. And many journalists, numerous journalists, when asked why they downplayed that story, said that because they know that John McCain is an expert in foreign affairs and because they know that he's honest, it can't possibly be the case that he was ignorant about what he was talking about, nor can it be the case that he was actively deceiving or intentionally misleading the public. It must have just been that it was sort of a negligible disconnect, a misspeaking incident between his brain and his mouth, and therefore it wasn't newsworthy. So the fact that they revere him personally and have an enormously high opinion of his character and integrity means that they won't see stories that reflect negatively on him as newsworthy, because by definition, stories that reflect negatively on John McCain's character or integrity must not really be news. And that's clearly what dictates the coverage.
This was that clip I believe John McCain was in Jordan. He was standing with South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, who had also gone on that trip, as well as Joseph Lieberman, who has been traveling with him in the United States and was also with him on the Middle East trip. This is what John McCain had to say.
Well, it's common knowledge and has been reported in the media that that Al-Qaeda is going back into Iran and receiving training and are coming back into Iraq from Iran. That's well known, and it's unfortunate. So I believe that we are succeeding in Iraq. The situation is dramatically improved, but I also want to emphasize time and again, Al-Qaeda is on the run, but they are not defeated. The Iranians are training extremists, not Al-Qaeda. Not Al-Qaeda. I'm sorry.
And for our radio listeners, that was Joseph Lieberman whispering in his ear and then John McCain correcting himself. Glenn Greenwald, you write about the Limbaugh-Crystal Fox News right-wing faction that controls the political party, the Republican Party. What about the media?
Well, I mean, you know, what media critics can describe how the media functions and point to all sorts of data and stories and narratives that we've been discussing today. But ultimately, often the most conclusive evidence of what the media is and how they function come from journalists themselves when they unintentionally reveal how it is that their profession operates. And to me, one of the most extraordinary and revealing statements came from a book called How to Win, by two of the most establishment journalists in America, Mark Halperin, formerly of ABC News and now of Time Magazine, and John Harris, who is the national political director of the Washington Post and is now at the Politico. And they famously wrote a chapter entitled that examined the role that Matt Drudge plays in how our political coverage is shaped. And what they said was that Matt Drudge is the Walter Cronkite of our era, that there's no single individual who shapes media coverage, and especially election coverage, more than he does, and their motto was Drudge rules our world, that media executives and producers and editors and the establishment press across the board obsessively check Drudge, because whatever stories he has are the narratives that will end up being predominating in the media. And the fact that, you know,
Drudge,
Matt Drudge, who in the 1990s was considered such a low-life gossip that no establishment media outlet would even mention him or report on what he said, had not more than 10 years later become the single most influential figure in our political process, tells you much, if not almost everything, of what we need to know about how our political press functions. I mean, he's not just a gossip monger, although he is, and one completely unbound by considerations of truth and fact, although he is that too. He's a distinctly right-wing polemicist with a right-wing agenda. And so the idea that our establishment press, and since Halperin and Harris said it, many, many other establishment journalists and news executives have said the same thing, the fact that our press is sort of guided by a right-wing gossip monger tells you all you need to know about the content of our establishment press, the liberal media. And one need only look to the journalists themselves to describe how it is that they function, and one can see that that's the case.
Well, I want to thank you, Glenn Greenwald, for joining us. Glenn's new book is called Great American Hypocrites, Toppling the Big Myths of Republican Politics. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting from Houston, Texas. We'll be back in a minute.
Who's afraid of the sun? Who would question the goodness of the mighty? We who banish the threat. When your little ones all go nighty-nighty, well, there's no time for doubt right now and less time to explain. So get back on your horses, kiss my ring, and join our next campaign. And the empire grows with the news that we're winning, with more fear to conquer and more gold thread for spinning. Our words. continuously churlish. Words are just words. Don't be so pessimistic, weak and girlish. We like strong, happy people who don't think there's something wrong with pride. Work makes them free, and we spread that.
By Dar Williams here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. It sounds like a fast food franchise. Hundreds of locations spanning some 130 countries across the globe. But in fact, it's perhaps the ultimate face of U.S. hegemony, military bases. There are more than 700 U.S. military bases worldwide, used for launching wars, holding prisoners, testing weapons. One could be closing down in Ecuador, where lawmakers recently approved a ban on foreign bases. The Ecuadorian president, Rafael Correa, has famously quipped that he'll let the U.S. military remain if the U.S. agrees to an Ecuadorian military base in Miami. Well, things are different in Europe, where the Bush administration now appears to have secured plans for its proposed missile system. U.S. missiles would be stationed in Poland, along with a radar site in the Czech Republic. Earlier this month, NATO leaders met in Romania and endorsed the missile plans. The Czech foreign minister, Karel Schwarzenberg, said a formal accord will likely come next month.
I met with the U.S. Secretary of State in friendly talks where we discussed the plan to have a radar facility as part of our NATO defense system. Once we are clear about the contents, we will discuss the possibility of signing the agreement. The first week of May looks like a good time to sign.
Majorities in both Poland and the Czech Republic oppose the missile plan, which is widely seen as a first strike threat against Iran. Two activists are in the United States now speaking as part of a campaign called No Bases for Empire. They're joining me from Washington, D.C. Jan Tamas is from the Czech Republic. He's the founder of the No Bases Initiative, a coalition against the proposed U.S. missile system in Eastern Europe. I'm also joined by Olivier Banquels. He is has been expelled from his native Diego Garcia, where he was when he was 4 years old. The U.S. has operated a military base there since British forces expelled native islanders in the early 70s. Olivier is with the Chagos refugee group. I want to begin with Jan Tamas. Talk about the Czech Republic.
Hello. Hello to you, Amy, and all the listeners. Well, yes, like you said, the majority of Czech people oppose this project. 70% of people have been steadily opposing this for the last 2 years. And the reason why we oppose it is that we really do fear that this will lead to new arms race, that this may lead to a new Cold War. And in fact, some of the statements by the Russian President Putin prove that that's actually the case. They do feel threatened by this, and they do say that they will need to take measures to respond to this. You have to keep in mind that no matter how sophisticated a military system the U.S. is going to implement, the enemy is always going to be able to implement other measures that will overcome it. And so the U.S. will then have to take other measures to overcome the countermeasures of the enemy. And in this way, you begin to have this spiral of armament. And so that's the new Cold War. Or it could even be a hot war. We don't know. So we believe that the way to achieve peace in in Europe, in the world, is actually by disarming and not creating new military bases, not by arming.
What is the attitude of people in the Czech Republic right now?
I'm sorry?
With the attitude of people in the Czech Republic to the base?
Well, since the first polls that were conducted back in August 2006, where 73% of Czechs opposed it, it's steadily around that number. More than two-thirds of people oppose this, but our government continues the negotiations as if nothing has happened. And so we really see this as a deficit in democracy, because we believe in a truly democratic society, the politicians should reflect on the will and the voice of the people. However, that's not the case in our country. And I would just like to say one thing. We've heard our foreign minister before saying that the deal will be signed sometimes during the first week of May. That is the truth. However, that will only be the agreement between the governments. And what has to happen in our country is that deal then has to be passed. It has to be ratified by the Czech parliament. And the situation is far from clear because the government has a very small mandate. They don't even have a majority. They were only able to pass a confidence vote after 7 months of negotiations, and thanks to some two members of parliament that didn't vote against them. So they have a very weak mandate, and it's far from clear how the vote will go. That's why we have now intensified our campaign. We are more than 60 organizations from all kinds of different backgrounds, and we are now, among other things, having an online petition on the website nonviolence.cz, where we would like to have 1 million signatures within the next few weeks, so that we would intensify the pressure on the Czech parliamentarians, so that they would not be willing to raise their hands for this dangerous system.
I wanted to turn to Olivier Bancolt of the Chagos Refugee Group. You left Diego Garcia when you were 4 years old. You were expelled. Explain what's happening on your island.
Yeah, on our island, it had been decided in 1965 that all the people have to move in order to make place for U.S. military base. All the removal started on Diego Garcia, where it had been used to build a U.S. military base. But first of all, I have to let people know that before choosing Diego Garcia, the choice was making on an island called Aldabra, where there were a population of giant tortoises. When the expert, American expert and U.S. UK expert going visit Aldabra, they have found a population of giant tortoises. They decided just to leave these tortoises in peace and just make the second choice, that is on Diego Garcia, where human beings were having his wonderful life. When the removal started on Diego Garcia, they just used to kill more than 1,500 dogs in order to frighten people to leave, because without the dogs, the island will become dangerous. I was age 4, and the reason I was forced to go to Mauritius because my sister was, I've been hurt by a wildcat, and when my mom decided to have treatment for my sister and in a view to return back in Perros Banos. But arriving in Mauritius 2 months after my sister passed away, when we decided to return, we have learned that island had been given to American. And what's the way? All those who were living on the island had been asked that they have to leave, and there is no communication. All things had been cut. All the link with Mauritius had been cut. That is in a very shameful way and forcible way that we have been uprooted from our motherland, the Chagos Archipelago.
You are awaiting a high court decision in Britain, your case expected to be heard on June 30th. What will happen there?
Yeah, as you know, since 1997, we started legal procedure against British government, because we think that what has been done to us is unlawful, because our fundamental rights as a human being have been violated by the UK government, because there is an ordinance, 1971, who said that no native can return back to their homeland, whereas UK and US soldiers can do so. We started, and we have been able to win three cases in our favor, mostly where the judge concludes that what had been done to us is unlawful, and then we are belongers, and that what had been done is very repugnant, and the Queen have the right to govern, but don't have the right to remove people, everything. But now, still now, the UK government still giving us a very hard time. It just so bring it to the House of Lords, but even that, we will not give up our struggle. On the 30th of June this year, we'll have the appeal from the British government to our case, and this will be heard in the House of Lords, where we shall be present. Of course, we are very optimistic because we think that justice must be done against in our case for all variation, for all inhuman that had been done to us.
Jan Thomas, final words as you are wrapping up your journey around the United States in this No Bases for Empire project.
Yeah.
Well, I would say we are understanding that we are fighting a global enemy, the corporations that are going to make huge profits on this. Already more than $100 billion have been spent on the missile defense itself, and it's not even near to working. These huge profits are being made by global corporations. They cross boundaries as if they don't exist, and so need we. We also, the peace movement needs to become global, and that's why I'm here as part of this this tour. To intensify the links, to intensify the cooperation across the Atlantic, across the boundaries of countries and across the different organizations, so that together we have a stronger chance of winning this nonviolent battle against this armament effort that is underway right now.
Jan Thomas and Olivier Bankholt, both of the No Bases for Empire Project, want to thank you very much for joining us from Washington, D.C. And that does it for our broadcast. I want to say special thanks to Dennis Moynihan and to David Goodman here in Texas, and to Shrif Abdelkaddous and to Miguel Noguera and to Nicole Salazar and Becca Staley and Steve Martinez in Washington, D.C. We are continuing our 12th anniversary Democracy Now! Tour, standing up to the madness around the country. Tonight will be in Albuquerque, New Mexico, tomorrow in Santa Fe, tomorrow night in Taos, then on to Salida and Alamosa and Denver, Colorado Springs, Salt Lake City. You can go to our website, democracynow.org, for details. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.